I had not been at home above 10 days when Captain William Robinson, a Cornishman, commander of the Hopewell, a stout ship of 300 tons, came to my house, asking whether I... adding that he intended to voyage. At last he pledged apologies to be surgeon of the ship. He said so many obliging things, and I knew him to be so... his proposal. The thirst I had of seeing the world, notwithstanding my past misfortunes, continuing as violent as ever. We set out the 5th day of August, 1706, and arrived at Fort St. George, the 11th of April, 1707. He bought a sloop, loaded it with several sorts of goods, wherewith the Tonquinese usually trade to the neighbouring islands, and putting 14 men on board, whereof 3 were of the country, he appointed me master of the sloop, and gave me power to traffic, while he transacted his affairs at Tonquin. We had not sailed above 3 days, when a great storm arising, we were driven 5 days to the north-northeast, and then to the east. Upon the 10th day we were chased by 2 pirates, who soon overtook us, for my sloop was so deep loaden that she sailed very slow. Neither were we in condition to defend ourselves. We were boarded about the same time by both the pirates, who entered furiously at the head of their men. But finding us all prostrate upon our faces, for so I gave order, they pinioned us with strong ropes, and setting a guard upon us, went to search the sloop. I observed among them a Dutchman, who seemed to be of some authority, although he were not commander of either ship. He knew us by our countenances to be Englishmen, and jabbering to us in his own language, swore we should be tied back to back and thrown into the sea. I spoke Dutch tolerably well. I told him who we were, and begged him, in consideration of our being Christians and Protestants of neighboring countries in strict alliance, that he would move the captains to take some pity on us. This inflamed his rage. He repeated his threatenings, and turning to his companions, spoke with great vehemence in the Japanese language, as I suppose, often using the word Christianos. The largest of the 2 pirate ships was commanded by a Japanese captain, who spoke a little Dutch, but very imperfectly. He came up to me, and after several questions, which I answered in great humility, he said we should not die. I made the captain a very low bow, and then, turning to the Dutchman, said, I was sorry to find more mercy in a heathen than in a brother Christian, but I soon had reason to repent those foolish words, for that malicious reprobate, having often endeavoured in vain to persuade both the captains that I might be thrown into the sea, which they would not yield to after the promise made me that I should not die, however, prevailed so far as to have a punishment inflicted on me worse in all human appearance than death itself. It was determined that I should be set adrift in a small canoe with paddles and a sail and 4 days' provisions. When I was at some distance from the pirates, I discovered by my pocket glass several islands to the southeast. I set up my sail, the wind being fair, with a design to reach the nearest of those islands. Let it suffice that on the 5th day, I arrived at the last island in my sight, which lay south-southeast to the former. I considered how impossible it was to preserve my life in so desolate a place, and how miserable my end must be. Yet I found myself so listless and desponding that I had not the heart to rise. And before I could get spirits enough to creep out of my cave, the day was far advanced. I walked a while among the rocks. The sky was perfectly clear, and the sun so hot that I was forced to turn my face from it, when all of a sudden it became obscured, as I thought, in a manner very different from what happens by the interposition of a cloud. I turned back, and perceived a vast opaque body between me and the sun, moving forwards towards the island. It seemed to be about 2 miles high, and hid the sun 6 or 7 minutes, but I did not observe the air to be much colder, or the sky more darkened, than if I had stood under the shade of a mountain. As it approached nearer over the place where I was, it appeared to be a firm substance, the bottom flat, smooth, and shining very bright from the reflection of the sea below. I stood upon a height about 200 yards from the shore and saw this vast body descending almost to a parallel with me, at less than an English mile distance. I took out my pocket perspective and could plainly discover numbers of people moving up and down the sides of it, which appeared to be sloping. But what these people were doing, I was not able to distinguish. The natural love of life gave me some inward motions of joy, and I was ready to entertain a hope that this adventure might some way or other help to deliver me from the desolate place and condition I was in. But at the same time, the reader can hardly conceive my astonishment to behold an island in the air, inhabited by men who were able, as it should seem, to raise or sink or put it into a progressive motion as they pleased. I waved my cap, for my hat was long since worn out, and my handkerchief towards the island, and upon its nearer approach I called and shouted with the utmost strength of my voice, and then, looking circumspectly, I beheld a crowd gathered to that side which was most in my view. I found, by their pointing towards me and to each other, that they plainly discovered me, although they made no return to my shouting. But I could see four or five men running in great haste up the stairs to the top of the island, who then disappeared. I happened rightly to conjecture that these were sent for orders to some person in authority upon that occasion. At length, one of them called out in a clear, polite, smooth dialect, not unlike in sound to the Italian, and therefore I returned an answer in that language, hoping at least that the cadence might be more agreeable to his ears. Although neither of us understood the other, yet my meaning was easily known, for the people saw the distress I was in. They made signs for me to come down from the rock and go towards the shore, which I accordingly did. And the flying island, being raised to a convenient height, the verge directly over me, a chain was let down from the lowest gallery with a seat fastened to the bottom, to which I fixed myself and was drawn up by pulleys. At my alighting, I was surrounded by a crowd of people. But those who stood nearest seemed to be of better quality. They beheld me with all the marks and circumstances of wonder. Neither, indeed, was I much in their debt, having never till then seen a race of mortals so singular in their shapes, habits, and countenances. Their heads were all reclined to the right or the left. One of their eyes turned inward and the other directly up to the zenith. Their outward garments were adorned with the figures of suns, moons, and stars, interwoven with those of fiddles, flutes, harps, trumpets, guitars, harpsichords, and many more instruments of music unknown to us in Europe. I observed here and there many in the habit of servants, with a blown bladder fastened like a flail to the end of a short stick which they carried in their hands. In each bladder was a small quantity of dried peas, or little pebbles, as I was afterwards informed. With these bladders they now and then flapped the mouths and ears of those who stood near them, of which practice I could not then conceive the meaning. It seems the minds of these people are so taken up with intense speculations that they neither can speak or attend to the discourses of others without being roused by some external taction upon the organs of speech and hearing, for which reason those persons who are able to afford it always keep a flapper, the original is Climenol, in their family as one of their domestics, nor ever walk abroad or make visits without him. And the business of this officer is, when two or more persons are in company, gently to strike with his bladder the mouth of him who is to speak, and the right ear of him or them to whom the speaker addresseth himself. This flapper is likewise employed diligently to attend his master in his walks, and upon occasion to give him a soft flap on his eyes, because he's always so wrapped up in cogitation that he's in manifest danger of falling down every precipice and bouncing his head against every post, and in the streets of jostling others, or being jostled himself into the kennel. At last we entered the palace and proceeded into the chamber of presence, where I saw the king seated on his throne, attended on each side by persons of prime quality. Before the throne was a large table filled with globes and spheres and mathematical instruments of all kinds. His Majesty took not the least notice of us, although our entrance was not without sufficient noise by all the concourse of persons belonging to the court. But he was then deep in a problem, and we attended at least an hour before he could solve it. There stood by him on each side a young page with flaps in their hands. And when they saw he was at leisure, one of them gently struck his mouth and the other his right ear, at which he started like one awaked on the sudden, and looking towards me and the company I was in, recollected the occasion of our coming, whereof he had been informed before. He spoke some words, whereupon immediately a young man with a flap came up to my side and flapped me gently on the right ear. But I made signs, as well as I could, that I had no occasion for such an instrument, which, as I afterwards found, gave His Majesty and the whole court a very mean opinion of my understanding. The king, as far as I could conjecture, asked me several questions, and I addressed myself to him in all the languages I had. When it was found that I could neither understand nor be understood, I was conducted by his order to an apartment in his palace, this prince being distinguished above all his predecessors for his hospitality to strangers, where two servants were appointed to attend me. My dinner was brought, and four persons of quality, whom I remembered to have seen very near the king's person, did me the honour to dine with me. In the first course, there was a shoulder of mutton, cut into an equilateral triangle, a piece of beef into a rhomboid, into a cycloid. The second course was two ducks, trussed up into the form of fiddles, sausages and puddings resembling flutes and hautboys, and a breast of veal in the shape of a harp. The servants cut our bread into cones, cylinders, parallelograms, and several other mathematical figures. Those to whom the king had entrusted me, observing how ill I was clad, ordered a tailor to come next morning and take my measure for a suit of clothes. This operator did his office after a different manner from those of his trade in Europe. He first took my altitude by a quadrant, and then, with rule and compasses, described the dimensions and outlines of my whole body, all of which he entered upon paper, and in 6 days brought my clothes, very ill-made and quite out of shape, by happening to mistake a figure in the calculation. But my comfort was that I observed such accidents very frequent and little regarded. On the second morning, about 11 o'clock, the king himself in person, attended by his nobility, courtiers, and officers, having prepared all their musical instruments, played on them for 3 hours without intermission, so that I was quite stunned with the noise. Neither could I possibly guess the meaning till my tutor informed me. He said that the people of their island had their ears adapted to hear the music of the spheres, which always played at certain periods, and the court was now prepared to bear their part in whatever instrument they most excelled. In our journey towards Lagado, the capital city, His Majesty ordered that the island should stop over certain towns and villages from whence he might receive the petitions of his subjects. And to this purpose, several pack threads were let down with small weights at the bottom. On these pack threads, the people strung their petitions, which mounted up directly like the scraps of paper fastened by schoolboys at the end of the string that holds their kite. Sometimes we received wine and victuals from below, which were drawn up by pulleys. The knowledge I had in mathematics gave me great assistance in acquiring their phraseology, which depended much upon that science and music. And in the latter, I was not unskilled. Their ideas are perpetually conversant in lines and figures. If they would, for example, praise the beauty of a woman or any other animal, they describe it by rhombs, circles, parallelograms, ellipses, and other geometrical terms. Their houses are very ill built, the walls bevel, without one right angle in any apartment. And this defect ariseth from the contempt they bear for practical geometry, which they despise as vulgar and mechanic, those instructions they give being too refined for the intellects of their workmen, which occasions perpetual mistakes. And although they are dexterous enough upon a piece of paper, and in the management of the rule, the pencil, and the divider, yet in the common actions and behavior of life, I have not seen a more clumsy, awkward, and unhandy people. These people are under continual disquietudes, never enjoying a minute's peace of mind, and their disturbances proceed from causes which very little affect the rest of mortals. Their apprehensions arise from several changes they dread in the celestial bodies. For instance, that the Earth, by the continual approaches of the sun towards it, must in course of time be absorbed or swallowed up. That the face of the sun will, by degrees, be encrusted with its own effluvia and give no more light to the world. That the Earth very narrowly escaped a brush from the tail of the last comet, which would have infallibly reduced it to ashes. And that the next, which they have calculated for 130 years hence, will probably destroy us. They're so perpetually alarmed with the apprehensions of these and the like impending dangers that they can neither sleep quietly in their beds nor have any relish for the common pleasures or amusements of life. When they meet an acquaintance in the morning, the first question is about the sun's health, how he looked at his setting and rising, and what hopes they have to avoid the stroke of the approaching comet. This conversation they are apt to run into with the same temper that boys discover in delighting to hear terrible stories of sprites and hobgoblins, which they greedily listen to and dare not go to bed for fear. The women of the island have abundance of vivacity. They contemn their husbands and are exceedingly fond of strangers, whereof there is always a considerable number from the continent below. Among these, the ladies choose their gallants. But the vexation is that they act with too much ease and security, for the husband is always so wrapped in speculation that the mistress and lover may proceed to the greatest familiarities before his face, if he be but provided with paper and implements, and without his flapper at his side. The wives and daughters lament their confinement to the island, although I think it is the most delicious spot of ground in the world. And although they live here in the greatest plenty and magnificence, and are allowed to do whatever they please, they long to see the world and take the diversions of the metropolis, which they're not allowed to do without a particular license from the king. And this is not easy to be obtained, because the people of quality have found, by frequent experience, how hard it is to persuade their women to return from below. I was told that a great court lady, who had several children, is married to the Prime Minister, the richest subject in the kingdom, a very graceful person, extremely fond of her, and lives in the finest palace of the island, went down to Lagado on the pretense of health. There hid herself for several months, till the king sent a warrant to search for her. And she was found in an obscure eating house, all in rags, having pawned her clothes to maintain an old, deformed footman who beat her every day, and in whose company she was taken, much against her will. And although her husband received her with all possible kindness and without the least reproach, she soon after contrived to steal down again with all her jewels to the same gallant, and hath not been heard of since. I conversed only with women, tradesmen, flappers, and court pages during 2 months of my abode there, by which at last I rendered myself extremely contemptible. Yet these were the only people from whom I ever received a reasonable answer. I had obtained by hard study a good degree of knowledge in their language, but I was weary of being confined to an island where I received so little countenance, and resolved to leave it with the first opportunity. On the 16th day of February, I took leave of His Majesty and the court. The king made me a present to the value of about £200 English, together with a letter of recommendation to a friend of his in Lagado, the metropolis. The island being then hovering over a mountain about 2 miles from it, I was let down from the lowest gallery in the same manner that I'd been taken up. I felt some little satisfaction in finding myself on firm ground. I walked to the city without any concern, being clad like one of the natives, and sufficiently instructed to converse with them. I soon found out the person's house to whom I was recommended. This great lord, whose name was Munodi, ordered me an apartment in his own house, where I continued during my stay, and was entertained in a most hospitable manner. The next morning after my arrival, he took me in his chariot to see the town, which is about half the bigness of London, but the houses very strangely built, most of them out of repair. The people in the streets walk fast, look wild, their eyes fixed and were generally in rags. We passed through one of the town gates and went about 3 miles into the country, where I saw many labourers working with several sorts of tools in the ground, but was not able to conjecture what they were about, neither did I observe any expectation either of corn or grass, although the soil appeared to be excellent. I could not forbear admiring at these odd appearances, both in town and country, and I made bold to desire my conductor that he would be pleased to explain to me what could be meant by so many busy heads, hands, and faces, both in the streets and the fields, because I did not discover any good effects they produced. But on the contrary, I never knew a soil so unhappily cultivated, houses so ill-contrived and so ruinous, or a people whose countenances and habit expressed so much misery and want. The sum of his discourse was to this effect, that about 40 years ago certain persons went up to Laputa, either upon business or diversion, and after 5 months' continuance came back with a very little smattering in mathematics, but full of volatile spirits acquired in that airy region. That these persons, upon their return, began to dislike the management of everything below, and fell into schemes of putting all arts, sciences, languages, and mechanics upon a new foot. To this end, they procured a royal patent for erecting an academy of projectors in Lagado. His lordship added that he would not by any further particulars prevent the pleasure I would certainly take in viewing the grand academy, whither he was resolved I should go. And his excellency, considering the bad character he had in the academy, would not go with me himself, but recommended me to a friend of his to bear me company thither. I was received very kindly by the warden, and went for many days to the academy. Every room hath in it one or more projectors, and I believe I could not be in fewer than 500 rooms. The first man I saw was of a meagre aspect, with sooty hands and face, his hair and beard long, ragged, and singed in several places. His clothes, shirt, and skin were all of the same colour. He had been 8 years upon a project for extracting sunbeams out of cucumbers, which were to be put into vials hermetically sealed and let out to warm the air in raw, inclement summers. He told me he did not doubt in 8 years more that he should be able to supply the governor's gardens with sunshine at a reasonable rate, but he complained that his stock was low and entreated me to give him something as an encouragement to ingenuity, especially since this had been a very dear season for cucumbers. I made him a small present, for my lord had furnished me with money on purpose because he knew their practice of begging from all who go to see them. I went into another chamber, but was ready to hasten back, being almost overcome with a horrible stink. My conductor pressed me forward, conjuring me in a whisper to give no offence, which would be highly resented, and therefore I durst not so much as stop my nose. The projector of this cell was the most ancient student of the academy. His face and beard were of a pale yellow, his hands and clothes daubed over with filth. When I was presented to him, he gave me a very close embrace, a compliment I could well have excused. His employment from his first coming into the academy was an operation to reduce human excrement to its original food by separating the several parts, removing the tincture which it receives from the gall, making the odour exhale, and scumming off the saliva. He had a weekly allowance from the society of a vessel filled with human ordure, about the bigness of a Bristol barrel. In another apartment I was highly pleased with ploughing the ground with hogs to save the charges of ploughs, cattle, and labour. The method is this. In an acre of ground you bury at 6 inches distance and 8 deep a quantity of acorns, dates, chestnuts, and other masts or vegetables whereof those animals are fondest. Then you drive 600 or more of them into the field, where in a few days they will root up the whole ground in search of their food, and make it fit for sowing, at the same time manuring it with their dung. It is true, upon experiment they found the charge and trouble very great, and they had little or no crop. However, it's not doubted that this invention may be capable of great improvement. We next went to the School of Languages, where three professors sat in consultation upon improving that of their own country. The first project was to shorten discourse by cutting polysyllables into one and leaving out verbs and participles, because in reality all things imaginable are but nouns. The other was a scheme for entirely abolishing all words whatsoever. And this was urged as a great advantage in point of health as well as brevity, for it is plain that every word we speak is in some degree a diminution of our lungs by corrosion, and consequently contributes to the shortening of our lives. An expedient was therefore offered that since words are only names for things, it would be more convenient for all men to carry about with them such things as were necessary to express the particular business they are to discourse on. Many of the most learned and wise adhere to the new scheme of expressing themselves by things, which hath only this inconvenience attending it, that if a man's business be very great and of various kinds, he must be obliged in proportion to carry a greater bundle of things upon his back, unless he can afford one or two strong servants to attend him. I have often beheld two of these sages almost sinking under the weight of their packs, like peddlers among us, who, when they met in the streets, would lay down their loads, open their sacks, and hold conversation for an hour together, then put up their implements, help each other to resume their burdens, and take their leave. But for short conversations, a man may carry implements in his pockets and under his arms, enough to supply him, and in his house he cannot be at a loss. I saw nothing in this country that could invite me to a longer continuance, and began to think of returning to England.